Into our Bible study here, and I put some stuff on the board this evening, and I kind of approach this as, you know, I'm just one learner speaking to some other learners, and we are going to look at Samson tonight, but I want to preface my statement with some things out of John chapter 17. So if you'll turn there with me. And it helps me to think in terms, you know, get some things out in front of me like this. And I just wonder, what is God doing? Because after all, that's our foremost interest, isn't it? And we get so wrapped up in the physical events of life, and we would be much better off if we didn't get so wrapped up in that. Here in John chapter 17, verse 15, the high priestly prayer of Christ is a prayer for us. That is, this is how he prays for us. I pray not that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. So I made up this whole thing here, you know, on the board. And here is life from man's point of view, and here is life from God's point of view. This is the physical world. This is the spiritual kingdom. And all these blue X's represent unsaved people in the world. And these red circles represent believers in the world. And Christ has come into the world, and in the 15th chapter of the Gospel of John, we find this, that he says, ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you and ordained you that you should go and bring forth fruit, and that your fruit should remain. So he chooses us. He sends us into this world. And I just have a sneaking suspicion that he is administratively very active in doing that. He's very careful about where he locates us. And we are strategically placed in this world as his representatives. And quite frankly, I would rearrange that if I was in charge. I would keep my fruit closer to me so I could enjoy it every day. I see what's happened here at Bethel, and I just see so much of our fruit way off in different places, you know. And by God's direction is the only way I can understand it, you know. From the missionaries that have come out of this church and gone to far-flung places, to other people who have grown up, you know, and been trained in this church and are off, way off someplace else, you know. And I'd rather have them here, you know, because it seems to me like we're not getting anything done. I don't see any physical evidence, you know, of God's blessing on the work so much. And I'm glad God leaves us some of them. Ryan, I'm so glad you're here. Set your feet in concrete, you know. But then he's brought Bruce and Lois from Minnesota, so what are we complaining about, you know? We get our transplants also, and Mark's up here from Darby.
We're here so you can say there, but by the grace of God, I'm speaking for myself.
Not Lois. I understand. Well, we need a couple of those. Jason is from everywhere. But anyway, we get them over. But we are to be in the world, but not of the world. And that's a real challenge. And I'm thinking of this because I'm thinking about Samson. Samson is a unique story. Now, you've got these people in the world, and it's just going to be common for them to be driven by very physical goals and circumstances. You know, houses, land, jobs, money, experiences, pickup trucks. Okay, now, and none of these things are necessarily evil, okay? But they're the driving forces of the world. Whereas, by contrast, over here, you know, we who know Christ are to be in the world and not of the world, so we should be driven by the fruit of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, and then the other six. We go down, oh, you know. That should be what drives and moves and motivates us while we're over here, and that's what makes us salt and light and profitable to God in the world. And that certainly is a huge challenge, to maintain a spiritual perspective while we live out here in the world, because, you know, we're interacting with these people all the time. And so we are getting counterproductive information, and we're getting counterproductive motivation, counterproductive stimulation while we're in here, while we attempt to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. So it's not an easy job to be God's people in the world. So we're going to have to work real hard at that. Now, there was one unique person in the world: Jesus Christ. We read about him this week in the Gospel of John. And a verse that I had read time and again, and when I came to it, I'm starting to feel guilty about the things that I don't know. And I read that and I didn't understand it. I just went past it and I came back and I said, what if somebody asked me a question about that sometime? Now, I'm not saying that I think I ought to have the answer to everything, but some things, you know, I think he was talking to the disciples about their temptation. And this was during the period of time of his crucifixion. And he said to them, the prince of the world cometh, and he hath nothing in me. In that particular chapter, he talks about two comings. He talks about the coming of the Holy Spirit. He talks about the prince of the world cometh. He said, the prince of the world cometh, and he hath nothing in me. And I've read that for 60-some years, Ruth. And I finally decided I'm going to puzzle over that a little bit, think about it. Pulled some of my favorite counselors down off the shelf and did some reading about it. And I've come to this conclusion that what Christ was saying was that he did not have an old nature, and there was nothing in him that Satan could appeal to. And that's kind of an interesting thing for us to understand. Again, we've been talking about the humanity of Christ, you know, and the deity of Christ. But we understand that while he was man without sin. And I kind of think that that's what that statement meant, was that he hath nothing in me that he can appeal to. I say that by reason of contrast, because over here, Satan has wherewith to appeal to us, because we're yet in the flesh. And that's why Paul said in the book of Romans chapter 8, walk in the Spirit and you'll not fulfill the lust of the flesh. It is a deft exercise that we walk as the children of God. Well, I want to take you now back to the book of Judges and show you a guy who I think God has recorded for us because he didn't do a very good job. The book of Judges, chapter 13, we're going to start in. And I warned my Sunday school class Sunday morning. I said, I think I'm probably going to do this. And as you think about Samson in the book of Judges, and I just want to think with you about it for a minute, one of our first observations is that of all the judges, he's the least attractive. Now, you know, it makes for good stories because he was very strong and he performed great feats, you know. When the Philistines came after him, he picked up the jawbone of a donkey as a weapon and killed 1,000 Philistines. Imagine that, you know. But we read about him and we think, Samson, why are you doing that, you know? And I still remember this sermon by an old evangelist. It was a sermon that God used greatly in my life where I really was challenged about my sin nature. I still remember. I remember that night crystal clear. It was in Omaha, Nebraska. It was 1967. And his sermon outline was sin binds, grinds, and blinds. And he just used the life of Samson to show the destructive nature of sin. And God used that wonderfully in my life. Another thing, there is more ink given to the life of Samson in the book of Judges than any of the other judges. So simply by the law of amount or whatever, it's obviously an important lesson for us. The Holy Spirit chose to settle down on this particular judge, I think in contrast to the other judges, and give us a lot of information. You know, other judges merit maybe half a verse, just an afterthought as a mention, and they probably had ministries every bit as valid and influential and beneficial as Samson's. But there's something characteristic about Samson that God wants us to learn. And with that in mind, just to stimulate your thinking a little bit, what do you admire about Samson?
Well, you've got to admire his strength and stuff. But I mean, as far as the man himself, there's really nothing to admire. I mean, he had strength given to him by God. He even misused that. So
there's one verse. The one verse that says, and Samson ruled as a judge over Israel for 20 years. So you're thinking that somewhere in those 20 years, obviously he was a judge.
So you're thinking maybe in those 20 years there was something good.
He must have got something right in 20 years.
No. That's a supposition. We don't know that for true, but okay. The point of that question was this. We don't find much to admire about Samson. We just don't. What are your grievances with Samson? Pardon me?
He didn't walk with God. I mean, continually, or he wouldn't have done the things that he did.
Esther?
He didn't respect his parents, and he didn't respect God either.
He didn't respect the women of his own faith. A, his activity with women was immoral, and B, they're all Philistine women.
He didn't respect his Nazarite vow. That right out of the get-go.
Nazarite vow, yeah. Yeah? I thought you said Nazareth, but Nazarite. Nazarite vow. Yeah.
But it says the child grew and the Lord blessed him. It says the child grew and the Lord blessed him.
That does not mean that we return the favor.
And also, every year I'm always baffled because
said, goes and shows disrespect to his parents and says, I want that woman who's killed, and he was not an Israelite. And yet, the next verses say, God did this because God wanted to deal with the Philistines. And then you go, somehow it's hard for me humanly to justify it. It's not hard to understand what God wanted to do, but it's hard to understand how it came about.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, let's pull out some verses now and just look at a few things. We're going to start in the 13th chapter and look at verse 1 through 5. And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines. 40 years. That'd be like from 1970 to 2010. Okay, I just say that for you to think in terms of the time, you know. For even the older ones of us, that's about the age of our oldest child. You know, all those years, okay, they were under the domination of the Philistines. And I want to suggest to you that it was probably longer than that. Because now Samson's going to be born to be the deliverer, and it's going to be probably 20 years before he gets active. So they may well be 60 years under the domination of these Philistines. And there was a certain man of Zorah, of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and bare not. Is that a double negative? Not a double negative, but it sure is affirmed. She is barren and she bare not. Again, I refer to Sunday, you know, being barren is not a pleasant experience. It was no fault of Manoah or his wife. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto the woman and said to her, behold, now thou art barren and bearest not, but thou shalt conceive and bear a son. Now therefore beware, I pray thee. Drink not wine nor strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing. For lo, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come on his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. Here we have another interesting demonstration of God's administrative work. God didn't run an ad in the Jerusalem Times saying, I'm looking for a judge or a deliverer. You know, send your resume to. He reached out into the future and grabbed a barren woman and her husband, caused them to give birth, and determined the purpose of that young child before he was ever born. This is the only case of that in the New Testament, in the Bible.
What do you think would be the significance of the Bible talking about a lot of Samson's mother, whatever her name, and a lot of other mothers were mentioned by name, but his mother was mentioned as the woman? Maybe he didn't put her name in there to spare the embarrassment of him or something.
Now I don't know, Bruce. We won't pursue that line of thought tonight.
Well, no, I'm just anyway, yeah. Woman, yeah. You know,
mm-hmm.
He actually gave the names.
Yeah. I said something, being facetious, that this is the only case of anybody like that. Jeremiah chapter 1. Before I formed thee in the womb, I knew thee and ordained thee a prophet to Israel. I think this is not unusual. It's more the norm that God establishes the purpose of our lives. I just made a quick little review in my own mind. God's servants are chosen, not solicited. And I made a just I started Genesis and started running through, and I'm You could name more, I'm sure, but Noah, Abraham, Joseph, Moses, Saul, David, Elisha. Ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you and ordained you that you should go and bring forth fruit and that your fruit should remain. Samson was one of those. The next observation I want to make is the purpose of Samson's life revolved around the condition of God's people. Isn't that interesting? God looked down and he saw the condition of Israel. Now, Israel's condition was self-inflicted. It strayed from the Lord. As a result, he sent or empowered the Philistines to take their freedoms away from them. We don't know, it's not recorded for us in this account, to what degree their freedoms were taken away from them. But they were obviously under the domination of a foreign empire, and their liberties were lost. They, I imagine, were under great taxation, for one thing, and that taxation would probably be taken in things like wheat and barley and sheep and things like that, cattle would be taken from them, kind of like our taxes are taken the same way, only it's by a foreign empire. And God determined to do something about it. He first determined to do it, and then he determined to do something about it. In determining to do something about it, he determined to use a person to do it. Now that's important for us to understand. God's work is often done through the co-laboring of his people. He involves us in the task. And here, Samson was chosen for that. This is a great honor, don't you think? To be chosen for this task. And I just say, isn't it a great honor for us to be chosen for this task over here? To be in the world but not of the world. To be salt and light. That's just a great honor to be there. The purpose of Samson's life revolved around the condition of God's people. Now, I've repeated myself there because I want to make this very clear, because this is the very place that Samson blows it. It was a matter of situation, time, and God's determination. The situation was such with Israel, and the time was such that deliverance was incumbent, and God had chosen Samson to do it. God had determined that 40 years was long enough, although it appears another 20 years approximately would be exhausted, to make preparations for their deliverance. Let me just take you to a psalm here with respect to that. Psalm, the sixth psalm. I just want to look at three verses there. Psalm 6, 1 through 3. O Lord, rebuke me not in thine anger, neither chasten me in thy hot displeasure. Have mercy upon me, O Lord, for I am weak. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are vexed. My soul is also sore vexed. But thou, O Lord, how long? Well, for Israel, it was 40 to 60 years. That's how long they were there. Now it's time to move Samson into action. Samson is a grown man, and it's time for him to move into action. And we pick that up in the 25th verse of the 13th chapter. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move him at times in the camp of David between Zorah and Eshtaol. So it says that the Spirit of the Lord began to move him. It doesn't say how or what, but it began to move him. Chapter 14, as a result, I think we can say, and Samson went down to Timnath and saw a woman in Timnath of the daughter of the Philistines. And he came up and told his father and his mother and said, I've seen a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me to wife. Then his father and his mother said unto him, is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren? That almost sounds like this isn't the first time, doesn't it? Is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren or among all the people that thou goest to take a wife of the uncircumcised Philistines? And Samson said unto his father, get her for me, get this, for she pleaseth me well. But his father and his mother knew not that it was of the Lord that he sought an occasion against the Philistines. For at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel. And again, my issue is to try to understand what God is doing and what life is like, and to be like the men of Issachar, to understand the times and know what ought to be done. And as I look at this story, I draw some conclusions. Now, these are just the conclusions that I draw, but hopefully it will stimulate some thinking. My first conclusion is this. It appears that with Samson, that until it became uniquely personal, he was not interested in entering into the fight. We don't find any place in the account of Samson where he was moved with any measure of compassion for the plight and place of Israel. Now, the purpose of his life was to deliver Israel. The purpose of his life wasn't to go out and find a wife that pleased him. But it appears that Samson, and this will probably come up in my notes as we go on, is so incredibly self-centered that the only way God can move him into action is to make it personal. He was called, he was equipped, but he was disinterested. I wonder if all things being written aforetime are written for our admonition and for our benefit upon whom the end of the ages have come. I wonder if part of this story isn't written for us to understand, to help us understand that God's people have the capacity to get all wrapped up in their own narrow interests and to avoid God's purpose for their lives. Unlike, say, Deborah, Barak, or Gideon, who had a more general and expansive interest in the nation, Samson never demonstrates that. The only thing that we find that ever moves Samson into action against the Philistines is his own personal anger against them for transgressing what he thinks are his rights. Amazing. I mean, it's not unusual that we would find very little to admire in this man. Pastor? Yes.
Do you think he was just the epitome of every Israelite at that time also?
No. I don't think so, because his own mom and dad were really disappointed in his behavior.
We see the verse several times. There was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So Samson sort of exalted version of that.
Yeah, yeah.
It could be a stereotype, just like anywhere, you know, there's a remnant that, and all in all, there's a remnant that, you know, gets saved or follow the Lord. So maybe there's still a remnant, but stereotype, maybe if you could work.
Yeah. Well, I think of when Elijah was so disappointed, God said to him, hold your horses, I've got 7,000 who haven't bowed their knees to Baal, you know. But those are all suppositions, Mark, and we can talk about them, but, you know, that's something we just can't necessarily know about. Samson was not to be moved into action until his own personal plans and pleasures were threatened and disrupted. There does not appear to be a solitary, altruistic motive in this man. What was his last act? Pardon me? Pulled the temple down. Okay, and for what reason? Revenge for his eyes. Yeah. Okay, well, our time's gone. What lessons should we learn from this story? Number one, shake ourselves free from the grasp of our own narrow self-interests. I think we have to constantly work at that. To shake ourselves free from our own narrow self-interests. There's an old proverb. This is not a Bible proverb. There's an old proverb that goes around. A man wrapped up in himself is a very small package. My second observation would be this, second lesson. Work and study to achieve a broader and encompassing understanding and interest in God's business. I think we ought to look beyond our own walls, beyond our own fences, to understand what's going on more broadly in this world so that we can understand our place as the people of God and serve Him faithfully in all that we do. And I think that's part and parcel of the Lord Jesus Christ saying, I'm come that you might have joy and that your joy might be full. There is nothing more satisfying than to understand that we're not living a life for just our own narrow, vain self-interests. That there's a much bigger program going on here. God is at work in this world, and He has chosen us to be involved in His operations. And what a wonderful and glorious thing that is. I think Samson lost the joy of that. Myriad are the numbers who have no interest in God until their own personal pursuits and pleasures are disrupted. You know, it's interesting how people get God conscious as soon as they get sick, you know, financial reversals and those kind of things. And they get angry and perform some mighty acts and, like Samson, go back right to their own narrow self-interests again. My point is their end becomes much the same as Samson. So my question is this, are we tethered to our own self-interest and disgruntled and unhappy? Or have we bought into a broader issue of life and understand God's calling and purpose for us? And are we enjoying our involvement in that purpose?